Good afternoon. It is just after 2 o'clock on another liquid sunshiny day. Everybody heard that liquid sunshiny day in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the state capitol, room 124, and you are joining us in Community and Regional Affairs Committee. We're here today to discuss House Bill 4002 and House Bill 4003. If you have cell phones or any kind of Blackberries, if you could turn those to an off position, even though they're silenced, it still can interrupt communication off net as well as in the room with our other electronic devices. So please turn those cell phones off so that we can hear what people have to say to us this afternoon. With me this afternoon, Representative Woody Salmon, co-chair Representative Gabriel Ledoux, and vice chair Representative Mark Newman, myself co-chair Representative Fairclough. We're hearing again from the administration today on two resource rebate. One is a resource rebate issue before us, and another is an act making some appropriations to the Alaska Energy Authority on power cost equalization. And so, Randy, if you would come forward and outline what you're going to present to the committee today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today, the administration will be addressing several issues that came up in deliberations or public testimony. One of those issues was hold harmless provisions, and there was some public testimony that perhaps our language in our bill wasn't thoroughly drafted or properly drafted. And Mr. Sherwood from Health and Social Services is here to speak to that today and explain it. We also have Mr. Hagenson here. The committee had a discussion about what are the other parts of the plan. This is the short-term piece, and what are we doing mid-term and long-term, and Mr. Hagenson's here to speak to that. And we also have, I think, Department of Law personnel on hand and Department of Health and Social Services folks on hand to answer any questions.
Thank you, Randy. For process information, the committee, Representative Ledoux and I have agreed that the committee would take presentations and that we would actually take up the bill tomorrow and take amendments tomorrow. But for those, again, joining us at home that aren't here today or don't have, some of the issues were regarding Representative Salmon talked about addresses, physical addresses being available in some parts of the community that he represents, and telephone numbers being an issue. And so we do have some preliminary drafts on an amendment that would address those. Representative Newman had talked about debts owed to the state of Alaska by child support, lack of child support, and how we might collect those in a distribution process. And then there's another consideration of an amendment to tie this for cost-saving measures to a distribution under the permanent fund, and somehow that super permanent fund dividend versus a resource rebate program. So those are the amendments that are would be under consideration, at least for conversation tomorrow. And members, as they fine-tune those, will make those available to the public tomorrow. If you're interested in a public testifying, if you're interested in testifying before the committee tomorrow and can't join us here in Juneau, you can call in on 888-295-4546. I'll repeat that again later in the day, 888-295-4546. You will only be allowed 3 minutes to testify, and we'd appreciate if you say your name and any affiliations that you might have for the record before you join us off net in that capacity. Our meeting tomorrow here in the State Capitol, room 124, will start at 10 a.m. And so the intent is to bring the bills before us one at a time and then hear from the public on those and then take amendments at that time. So it is Representative Ledoux and my hope that we will be able to complete that process tomorrow and move the bill out of committee at that point. Are there any questions from committee members on that process? Representative Cisna is also considering an amendment for tomorrow, and so she can speak to that maybe later in the day. I would like to acknowledge that we've been joined at the table by Representative Cisna, part of this committee, as well as Representative Olson. And thank you, Representative Bryce Edgman, for joining us today to listen to What this committee is trying to decide, whether it's energy issues across the state of Alaska or a rebate issue, and depending on the focus that we take, how we might proceed in legislation to move that forward. Any comments from other committee members? Online, we have with us this afternoon Mike Mitchell from the Department of Law, available for questions, as well as Rich Gazaway from, and two others from RCA. Representative Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Last time we met in Juneau, I asked Karen Rayfield, the director of OMB, just what types of plans the administration already had as far as expenditures from the state. I know that there's quite a few billions of dollars going out, billions of dollars going out for transportation needs to make sure our infrastructure is improved enough so that we can haul pipeline, somewhere $6 billion plus on that. More money for training for individuals to go to work on the pipeline by labor. The governor had a billion-dollar transportation bond bill that she was trying to work on, or a transportation plan. There's several multi-billion-dollar projects that have been presented by different departments within the administration. And I had asked Ms. Rayfield for a running toll on that. This is another billion-dollar project here, or close to $1 billion. Are we going to be able to hear from that? That was more than a week ago I asked for that. Are we going to be able to get that information before we vote on this so that we know just how much money is going out there? We know we've got Mr. Hagness in here. We're going to be talking about several more considerable large hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars for energy development, alternative energy development programs. They're starting to add up pretty fast. And I think that we need to talk about that.
Representative Newman, if we could hear from Steve Hagenson, maybe some of the questions will be answered, and if not, the co-chair and I are certainly willing to take up the conversation about if the committee wishes to delay for a day to give the administration time to address your needs. Right now, we've committed to the public as well as to the committee to, if at all possible, move the bill from committee tomorrow. But if something's not being addressed that you need to have before you make a decision whether to pass to move this forward, we can talk about that at the conclusion of today's meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, again, welcome to all those who are tuning in off-net and those here in Juneau today. Our first presenter, Steve Hagenson, if you'd join us and identify yourself for the record so that the clerk can hear your voice for transcription later.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Hagenson. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority and also the Statewide Energy Coordinator.
And, sir, you have a prepared presentation that the committee should have in front of them in the form of a colored PowerPoint.
Yes, I do.
And then available for those with us today in the audience that there is a black and white version outside the door. Is that your intention to go forward with a PowerPoint presentation?
If that's your wishes, Madam Chair.
Did you hear some of our discussion last week when we were talking about the committee is a little bit we're trying to figure out the exact stance we're taking at this particular issue. Originally, at least in the media, whether it's accurate or not, there may have been portrayed an energy relief going out to citizens of Alaska, which had the committee focusing on conservation issues, preservation issues, investment on resource dollars, and a myriad of other topics that were energy related. And then when we received the bill, it was a resource rebate bill, which sort of took us down another track in considerations on how we measure that and how quickly it needs to go. So the committee has differences of opinions on the eligibility requirements right now that's existing inside the current program. And please, committee members, if I'm not outlining it correctly, raise your hand and let's make sure that they get the appropriate thought process out here. But the eligibility requirement is one thing under energy rebate versus under resource rebate, and we see that somewhat differently affected. And energy is needed immediately, and a resource rebate we might think could just go right along with the permanent fund and save investment in bureaucracy versus allowing that to go out. So did you hear those issues before?
I heard of those comments, but I'm here to talk today to talk about the longer-term plan, the one to 10-year plan, not the immediate portion of the plan.
Okay, we'll let the administration speak then to try to clarify that particular issue. Mr. Hagenson, if you'd go forward with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about my favorite topic, energy. You know, on the first slide, I think maybe they're not numbered. They're not numbered, but I'll try and keep you on track. On the first slide, it talks about audience participation, and you don't have to figure out this number, but you can in your head. We'll get to a number later on. What's your estimate of the total yearly cost of your house per household of electric, space heating, and transportation for each of the following regions? You can think about that as we go on. The goal of the Alaska Energy Plan is really very simple. It's to reduce the cost of energy to all Alaskans. I'd like to rapidly deploy solutions. This is not about a study. This is about results. We'd like to get it out as fast as we can. The study will be complete. You mentioned some costing earlier. Representative Newman mentioned costing a certain components. We haven't gotten to that point yet. Right now we're in the process of putting the plan together, and it'll be done around December timeframe. If we have any solutions that we think we can deploy earlier than that through possibly HB 152 options, I think that would be a good way to move forward. But so that's our goal is very simple. The next slide talks about project results, and this is a mouthful. I'm going to read it to you. It says, identify and deploy energy resources that are vertically integrated, economic, long-term price stable, and sustainable. That's a mouthful. It's easy to say. It's hard to pull off. So we're in the process of trying to pull that off. And we came up with some guiding principles on the next slide. This first one is actually fairly important. And this recognizes the massive amount of money that we've already put into existing infrastructure. The Denali Commission and across Alaska has put hundreds of millions of dollars into infrastructure for generators, for tank storage, for hauling fuel. So we'd like to give you a fuel that you can use in existing infrastructure. It's one of our guiding principles. So if you have a boiler today in your house and you have liquid fuel in your boiler, we'll give you more liquid fuel, possibly in a different, from a different form or a different source, but it will be used in your same existing boiler. We'd also like to evaluate on a delivered cost basis. A friend of mine told me one time, he said, you can have all the waste heat on the North Slope for free, okay, for 50 years. And so I did the math, figured out that I have to, what it would take to convert that to electricity and then deliver it 500 miles to Fairbanks. And it came out to be 40% more than we're currently paying. So it's not free. So we're going to evaluate these projects on the cost of delivered energy, not just the cost of making the energy. We also like to, we're looking at using low profit models. It could be a port authority, joint action agency, co-op. It could even be a for-profit company like a native corporation that would like to take a lower profit margin to take care of their people. So we'd like to not have this to be a big profit-making entity, but to keep the money in the community. We'd like to minimize the risk of technology failures. Across Alaska, for many, many years, we've had some brilliant failures in the technology. It's been a test bed for a lot of different things. We'd like to minimize those. We want successes in this plan. I also want to engage Alaskans in the solution. This is critical. If you just give them money and say, go here's some money, they don't have any interest in the end result, and it tends to fail. So we'd like to get people involved. This will also allow the state of Alaska to leverage their money to a much better extent than just giving them all the money. We'd like to seek the lowest cost energy in each community. The next slide is easy to find. It's the one that has its color multicolors on it. This is a fun of a fun graph. And this is a one pager that shows all the energy in the world. The upper left-hand corner, you can see the solar radiation.
Mr. Hagenson, we have a question. Representative Newman.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hagenson, under the prior slide here, just two questions. On the evaluate costs on a delivered basis, or in, I guess maybe probably the use low profits business structure, go into that statement. Have you considered involving groups like the Resource Development Councils, Native corporations, who already have a infrastructure somewhat set up within themselves to help deliver these or to research programs to maybe help you gather information as to what parts of the state are doing what and what their needs are, because they're so different in different parts of the state. And for just your agency, the AEA, Alaska Energy Authority to try and gather that. You know, are you working with other groups to identify those exact needs throughout the state to help reduce your costs?
The simple answer is yes, we are. We've also had the 28, and I'll get that in a couple slides down the road, but by the next slide. We've gone to 28 communities across Alaska and asked the people in the communities what resources do they want us, do they know about that we wouldn't know about, and then also what they don't want us to use and why. So those are the kind of questions we're asking, and we've gotten some very good information. But we are involving pretty much anybody who wants to have it, has anybody who has passion. I'm looking for people who have passion to solve the problem, not just people who want to step in there and maybe be an anchor. So I'm looking for people who have passion to solve it.
One more question, Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also on the seek the lowest cost energy to each community. Now, different communities have different needs. I know in the Susitna Valley, a lot of my constituents are off the power grid or very near the power grid, but not on it. The state used to be able to, we used to have some capital project monies that went to Pioneer Extension Lines because these people are running diesel generators to run their homes right now, which when we're talking 50, 60, 70 cents a kilowatt hour to do that when they're several hundred yards from a power line. Do you anticipate any ability for the state to put money into the budget for Pioneer Extension Lines or people who live along, and I'm sure this follows along both Representative Edgman and Salmon's district and Ledoux's district and probably Kurt Olson's too, you know, the fact that we have people who live on the Yentna River who don't have power running off of diesel generation, where it's small scale, where you're just in an individual home, what opportunities are they going to have? So maybe through your presentation you could give us an idea of what an individual homeowner can do to help reduce their energy costs.
Okay.
Or what's available.
Through the chair, this is a pretty high level report we're looking at right now, and we're trying to identify the cheapest options out there. So if they're using diesel today and we can find a different option that's cheaper for them, we would recommend that they would look at that option. Okay. And we're looking at, as if there's an initial look anyhow, we're looking as if there's no subsidy at all from the state. The state can choose to put money in to make the deal better in the future. But right now, we're trying to identify cheaper alternatives than they have today. It could be biomass, it could be wind, it could be solar, it could be, you have to really look at the specific use. But at the high level, we're trying to identify those high level choices for the.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. If you'd continue, Steve.
So back on this, this is the chart I'm on right now. This is kind of a fun little graph to look at. And this is a one-page document that shows all the energy in the world. The upper left-hand corner shows you solar, which really drives wind, wind, rivers, clouds, hydroelectricity is really from solar, as is photosynthesis, which is all your carbon-based fuels in the world. So a lot of the energy in the world is really from the sun. On the bottom right-hand side shows nuclear options, and the bottom left-hand side shows earth crustal, and that little black line down the left-hand side shows gravitational, so like for tides and things like that. This is really the palette of colors you get to pick to paint your energy picture with. This is everything in the world. So if you like that, here's your palette. On the next slide is a list of all the communities we went and visited. And like I said earlier, we asked them three questions. What resources do you know of in your area that we may not know of? Because you eat, you fish, you hunt, you sleep out in these areas and play. What do you know about? And we got a lot of input, and people would say, well, when I go hunting in this one area, there's snow all around this area, but there's no snow right here, possible geothermal. Or when I go out in my boat, there's always a 15-knot tide right, or current right here in this one area. Or when I was a kid, I remember they went and drilled a gas well in the area, but they said it wasn't commercial. And so a non-commercial gas well, maybe it may mean it's not commercial to export it, but it may be commercial enough to run like Barrow does today on a gas well in the area. So we're trying to identify those resources. We're working with DNR geological surveys to identify the resources that are available out there and actually put them on a map so we can identify it and tie it back to the city or the community. We've now completed all these different studies, and we're working on developing a resource matrix, which has every community listed horizontally and every resource listed vertically. And we'll take that map and use it to take the next step on the process. Next slide. Identify the current fuel usage and cost. We started looking at this thing, and there's really no data available for this. So we went back and we said, well, we need some anecdotal data, because before you start figuring out what supply you're going to switch to or what fuel you're going to use, you have to figure out what your need level is. You have to identify, do I need 10 gallons of fuel for the year? Do I need 100,000 gallons of fuel? And you may have a different answer. So we went out and we looked at, we had one estimate that was 1,000 gallons per person per year in rural Alaska. And that, I think we adjusted it down to 750. We also had another rule of thumb that took the PCE fuel times a factor of 3 to 4, and that would give you the number of gallons you would use per person, because it would take into account home heating and PCE fuel for electricity. And that gets us somewhere between 39 million and 54 million gallons a year. So now that's kind of a target. And I'll get back to that number, because it's kind of an important number later on. Next slide, it shows us an energy slide. It has, it's kind of a multicolored thing. It shows the energy coming into Selawik. What's interesting about this is how many gallons of fuel go into electricity, how many gallons go into home heating oil, and you can see what the bill on the right-hand side would be for residential bill. And this would be right around $9,000 a year that they would pay in Selawik. The disturbing part is when you look at the lower left-hand corner, you see that that's $27,000 average household income in Selawik, which means that 33% of their cost of their energy is going to just heat and electricity. So that's a kind of a significant number. The other thing that's interesting is that there's $2.4 million that leaves Selawik every year, okay, just to pay for electricity. And we were talking about a rain barrel model. It's a rain barrel for economic model. You have money flowing in, you have money flowing out. The money flowing in comes from whatever sources you can have, from federal government or state government. But the money, or from private sales in the community, the money leaving the community is really from things that you buy outside of your area. And the biggest one probably in Selawik would be fuel. And that number is about $2.4 million. So as we looked at this thing, we looked at what local resources could we provide to keep the jobs local, to keep the money local, to really help your economy come back and be robust and actually grow your economy. So this is really about the economy more than it is about the cost of energy, in my mind.
If I might.
Yes, Madam Chair. And I can talk straight on, so just jump in.
This was the pause of where I and other committee members had questions about the administration's proposal and what was before us. And that is that I had listened to a presentation from you at the State Chamber of Commerce, and we talked about energy use per household. And that's where we are trying to ascertain whether we're taking the right direction in resource rebate, a flat distribution to everyone versus a targeted household energy cost, understanding that in Selawik, am I saying that correctly? That it's 33% of their income, and how we address those needs across Alaska versus a flat distribution. So, just so you know, that's why we wanted to talk to you. I appreciate the high level, but
and I have
committee
more,
wants
I have more data on
energy.
That also.
Okay.
And I'll get that in a few more slides. Next slide.
Representative Salmon, did you have a comment?
The question I have is, do you have to back up a couple pages to your fancy little page here?
Sure.
A little page. Right about on the right-hand side, kind of about in the middle, you have your river, 7.2 and 5.4.
Yes.
Seems to me if we're looking for alternative energy, do you think the Yukon River might be a source of energy in the area?
I'm absolutely kinetic through the chair, Mr. Salmon. The Yukon River has a large potential for kinetic hydropower. The question is, and the one concern we would have is, when you install that and those in the river, does it affect salmon? And when we go back to the community, we'd like to ask them what they want to do and what they would like to see used in their area. And they may say, we'd like, maybe it's the cheapest, but we don't want to use it because it may affect salmon runs. I know that there's actually some kinetic hydro going in Eagle this year, and that'll be kind of a test bed to see if it'll actually survive breakup. But it is a very good resource.
Anything else, Representative Salmon?
Yeah, I have a couple other questions, but seem like there's different types of, if you look at, some of the resources, they have different types of impellers or whatever, to turn the generators. I mean, you've got, the ones they got in Eagle seemed like the blades is pretty, you know, humongous, you know. But there seemed like there's a lot of other, you know, there's a lot of, I've seen studies back, you know, done back in the 1800s where they use fish wheel type, you know, where it doesn't even, you know, paddle type system. That doesn't affect fish at all. And there's, you know, a lot of other sources that could be, you know, employed, you know, battery system and converters and stuff like that. So, you know, there's a lot of other possibilities that you don't have to put regular in-river turbines. So.
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, I would agree with you. And we have a technology group that's actually looking at that technology to look at any way to make energy in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. Representative Ledoux.
Steve, I really appreciated your coming to Kodiak, and it was an absolutely gorgeous day, and yet you stayed all day in the college there at the town meeting. And you talked about the governor's proposal for giving funds to the utility companies. And after quite a bit of give and take and dialogue, you actually convinced me that that was a pretty good idea. But I don't see that anywhere here.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, that's correct. It's not being moved forward.
You convinced me in Kodiak that it was a great idea. What's the rationale why I'm not seeing it now?
I think it has to do with taxes. Obviously, at the original outcome of the thought, we believed that it would be non-taxable. Then as we looked into it more and more, we realized that it may be and probably would likely be taxable, and which then triggers the issue of W-2s. Now, if it's taxable now, you have to send a 1099 out to every individual because it's taxable income. And then you don't have, I think there's a form called a W-9, I think it is, which you have to fill out to get a 1099. And so it turned into a kind of a little bit more of a quagmire than we thought it was going to be and turned into something that we never dreamed.
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
I want to see if I understand correctly. You're telling me that if you give a rebate or give funds to regulated utilities and then they lower their rates, that it would become taxable income to the ratepayers? That doesn't sound right to me.
And that's where we started also. on advice of counsel, they said that it would more than likely be taxable.
Thank
so
you.
I would agree with you.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. You continue.
Okay. So now after your question, Madam Chair, we'll move to the next slide, which really is this is a very interesting slide. And this is the slide that if you look for it, there's no data. I mean, this was kind of created from what we believe is good information, but there's data is very hard to confirm. You can't go out to any list or any file and verify these numbers. So these are kind of based on the best available information to move forward. So what this is a comparative cost of gas in Anchorage. If you have a gas society like Anchorage does, it looks at Fairbanks under a diesel type society. It looks at hydro in Southeast. And this is obviously not Angoon or Cake that have diesel. Those would be more like in the rural area with diesel, and then also the rural area with diesel. In my professional opinion, I believe that all these numbers for the cost are pretty accurate. I looked at them myself and came up with some numbers, had an independent person verify them, and they came up with very close numbers. So we'll just we can go there and talk about these. Now, if you look at Anchorage, the total cost is about $5,900 a year. If you look at Fairbanks, it's about $9,400 a year. Southeast Alaska is about $4,900 a year. In rural Alaska, under diesel, is right around $10,000 a year. So then you start looking at, where's the incremental components of this? Look, and electric's about 50% more in rural than it is in electricity, partly because of PCEs existing right now. And if you look at the heat, that's kind of a telling number. You look at $1,000, just a little bit over $1,000 in Anchorage, up to about $7,700 in rural Alaska. That's the big hit. And they've got to heat their homes out there in rural Alaska. This has been adjusted for different parts of Alaska. But that's the big number that's different. The next chunk you look at would be transportation. Anchorage and Fairbanks would be the two higher because they probably have more roads and more access to roads. And then rural Alaska would be lower because of less access to roads. They probably don't drive quite so far. So that's how we get the components of this thing. The number that I had the biggest issue with was what's the average cost per household? And that's what you divide this by to see the percent of income. And what I looked at a lot of data. I finally went to DCED and asked them to give me these numbers, and they came back and said, well, here's the numbers and average. So these are the average numbers, and I think they're right, okay? The problem is if you go to a hub community versus a very remote community, you get different numbers. So if you go to a hub community like Bethel, you have a lot of teachers there, you have a lot of doctors there that maybe can skew the average, but it doesn't really address the low-income people. So on the next slide, it's actually an excerpt out of an ICER study that Senator Hoffman commissioned that looks at the cost across Alaska, or in basically Anchorage versus remote rural communities, and it breaks it into the top 20% of income, the 60% mid-cut income, and the 20% of low income. And you can see that the average numbers in the middle of 60 are about what we came up with on our study. This report does not include transportation. Okay, so it's going to be a little lower for some parts. But if you look at the lower 20% number in rural Alaska, you can see that 47% of their income goes to heating their home and making electricity. That's a significant number, and I'm not sure it's sustainable, but this is the best available data we can pull together to get our hands around this situation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hagenson, on the slide prior to that, when we're looking at electrical cost, is that before PCE or after PCE, and how is that affecting there?
It would be after PCE for rural Alaska, and the rest of the three would not include PCE.
So the
PCE number, I believe, is right around 31.5 cents. I think that's about the right floor, but 31.5 cents, I think, is the number of deduct from their rates. But the effect of that would be to drop it down, actually, according to this number, a little bit below what Fairbanks would pay.
So if we inject, Madam Chair, if we inject the effects of PCE into here, these electric costs would be lower?
Could you repeat that question again? If you inject,
well, when I'm looking here at rural, and it says electric $1,843.
Yes.
If we inject the effects of PCE into that, does that lower that number?
No. This includes the PCE.
So that includes,
already.
Okay.
That one number does.
Okay. And just if I may, Madam Chair, for a comment on the next slide is. It's interesting, the medium share of income in Alaska households for energy. And one thing that has kind of been rolling around in my simple mind is the fact that, and a number hit me earlier when you had the $2,400 per income for electricity, but the effect of property taxes and a lot of people who pay taxes, so there's other costs incurred by areas that are organized areas of the state is the areas that are unorganized areas of the state who don't receive PC and stuff. That's kind of interesting. And all those expenses, when you add those into somebody's income expenses type ratios, those numbers look a lot different, rural and urban. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, through the Chair, Representative Newman, that's absolutely correct. But we were looking just specifically at energy costs, so we didn't incorporate the total picture.
Thank you for that response. Representative Salmon.
Referring to that question over there about the PCE, the PCE is not everybody gets PCE. You'll have to, you know, it's a fact of a rural area. Some villages don't get it because there's a requirement on it. So could you explain that?
Through the Chair, Representative Salmon, I'm not an expert on PCE. But I believe that most of the remote communities either have access to PCE or receive it. The ones that don't receive it, I think off the top of my head, would be like Kodiak, I don't believe receives it. The Four Dam Pool utilities don't receive it. I know that Rail Belt utilities don't receive it. And I don't believe that Glen Allen, Copper Valley receives it. But other than that, I think most utilities either receive it or are eligible to receive it.
Representative Salmon, follow-up. We did hear some criteria listed at our last, not our meeting in Anchorage, but when we were here in Juneau, as far as the criteria for PCE. Representative Salmon, followed by Representative Ledoux.
But I just want to make this, that statement that not everybody in the village, just because they receive PCE, you know, for the program, doesn't mean that, you know, they all receive PCE. That's a known fact.
It's a good point, Representative Salmon.
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, I believe, are you talking about commercial versus residential?
No, just the residential.
Okay.
Not everybody receives it.
To support my colleague, what he's saying is when Urban Alaska is making reference to power cost equalization, that all is not equal, even in rural communities, and that's so noted. We understand. Representative Ledoux.
I'm trying to understand this graph, the estimated household costs for home energy use. Am I reading it right that for all households of all incomes, it's 4.7%? Is that?
That would be the, through the chair, co-chair Ledoux, that would be for the year 2008.
Okay. But then I'm looking at all of these other, you know, down below where it says 20%, 60%, 20%. And, I mean, in Anchorage, for the lowest 20%, it says it's 8.7. For other large road system communities, it's 17.9%. For remote rural communities, it's 47%. You look at the mid-range, and it goes from 3.6, 5.9 to 12.7, and then the high income, 2.0, 3.2, and 2.7. It just doesn't seem like it would just add up if you put those all together to just 4.7%, because those are some pretty substantial figures.
That through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, that's correct. They do add up. What they've taken is they've taken the 20%, we'll call it the poverty level for easier, okay, the 20% bottom, who make the lowest amount of money. So you'd expect to see a very high percentage of cost in that area. Just like on the high side, you see a high number. In the middle, 60% is going to be pretty close to that average. It's going to be swung a little bit depending on how many people are really in those sectors. But I believe that ICER did a good job here, and I think the math works on it, but I haven't personally verified the math.
Follow up, Representative Ledoux. In follow up to Representative Newman's question on power cost equalization, do you know that in the study that was done by ICER, whether the power cost equalization was a component that was already used in actual, or whether they added that back in for energy costs? You know if it was used in their study or not, as far as.
Yeah, that, no. Madam Chair, off the top of my head, I don't recall if it was used. I believe that they were using the actual dollars paid, so I think it would include PCE, would be my assumption.
Representative Ledoux.
So, this graph, figure one, the estimated, the ICER study from May 2008, that doesn't include transportation, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Is there an ICER study that perhaps does include transportation that we might be able to take a peek at?
I don't believe that's the case because this data does not exist. I mean, these guys are scrambling to get just the data we have here. And actually, AEA has hired ICER to go out and look at the amount of fuel used in each community. And when we asked them about the transportation, they got a little nervous about that. So I don't believe they have a model to even estimate that. They'll be working on a model for us to estimate the amount of fuel usage for home heating and electricity. We have that pretty much already. But they don't know the transportation number.
Representative Ledoux, follow up.
Well, then how did the AEA staff come up with transportation numbers in the previous graph?
I can tell you the methodology, but real shortly, what happened is Fairbanks had a study, and I was actually chairman of the group that did the study, and I went to the refiners and asked them, and they told me, no, we're not sharing that information with you. So I went to a friend of mine who was in the industry who had a market study that basically laid out all the transportation fuel, all the heating oil, and died and gone to heaven. It was a great source of data, and I used that on the Fairbanks study, and this is extrapolated off of that.
Representative Ledoux.
Then just one further follow-up. Couldn't ICER take that data that you've come up with in this AEA study and put it into the ICER study in order to come up with at least a rough calculation?
I think they could. It might be easier to take, through the chair, it might be easier to actually take the ICER data and put it into our study because...
Either way.
But I think I don't think our studies are that much different, to be honest.
Thank you.
Mr. Higginson, what we're struggling with, if I could be so bold as to try to say, is again, I believe legislators are concerned with delivering something that's fair and equitable across the state. And as Representative Salmon points out, all things are not equal in rural Alaska when we look at power cost equalization. And what Representative Newman points out, through property taxes and through different miles of lanes that you travel, urban Alaska is hit differently. And so we are trying to, shall we say, lift the clouds and really have the data on the table so that we can appropriately meet Alaskans' needs without getting into the mire of all the arguments that people keep saying, I travel more lane miles, I contribute more in property taxes, and we do not want to be divided, but we want to be united in addressing energy needs through Alaska, and we're looking for some clarity.
And Chairman, I agree with you. The data, and that's exactly the same discussions that the governor's energy team had when we talked about that. So it's hard to find the data. Our goal is just the same as yours, to be fair and just. There's no perfect plan out there. And so, you know, we've moved forward with something we think is going to work, but the data is not there, so we had to rely on some, I'll say, incomplete data, but it's fairly close.
Just a final editorial comment. Representative Bryce Edgman is at the table, and he and I looked at a legislative task force to be involved with this issue, and we were successful in rolling it into a passed piece of legislation last year, but the whole point from a legislation perspective versus an administrative perspective, if you come to the table and we don't believe you as a policy-making body, the criteria that you use on anything, that's what starts this rural-urban divide debate. And so we thought, and Representative Edgman, I'd certainly allow you, if I'm not categorizing our interests correctly, we thought that if you had legislative buy-in on some of the criteria and direction you were going, it would start the headway into having legislative buy-in that the process is fair and one that we can have confidence in those numbers. That Representative Edgman?
Madam Chairman, and just to add to that point, that the task force would also look at the bigger picture, some of the what the existing institutions are doing vis-a-vis, all marching towards the same direction but working separately. And this would be in concert with what you're doing, Mr. Higginson, and under the just sort of the umbrella statement that all hands on deck are necessary for this energy problem in front of us.
Thank you, Representative. Just for the committee, we do have other presenters that are in the queue and a substantial portion of this presentation to go forward. So no later than about 3:10, we'll be moving on to the next department that's here today to testify before the committee. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to make this very quick. Steve, when we're looking at these, particularly at the lowest incomes, where does low-income energy assistance come in? I know we added a substantial amount of more money into that. We changed the qualifications, I believe, this last year. So if they're in rural, remote, rural communities, it's 47% is of their income. Is some of that covered by energy assistance, or is that with or without energy assistance?
I'd like to yield the microphone to my colleague here, Mike Harper, from Alaska Energy Authority.
Yeah.
Mr. Harper, if you could identify yourself for the record so the clerk has your voice on record before they have to transcribe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Harper, and I'm Deputy Director of Rural Energy at the Alaska Energy Authority. Through the chair to Representative Newman. I believe you're talking about LIHEAP. Does that ring familiar?
Yes.
Low-income assistance for heating, home heating, basically. And that's for the entire state. That's a program run by another state agency, I believe, State Department of Health and Social Services. That's for both urban and village Alaska. And up until about a year ago, I believe that was funded at about, say, $9 million altogether for the entire state. And I think you all funded more this past session for the entire state. But that's run basically, I think, through some state agencies and also through some of the native nonprofit organizations out in rural Alaska. But it is definitely income-driven, low-income.
And Madam Chair, the only reason that I bring those issues up is I'm trying to get my arms around all the different costs that the states are going into. I believe we added $200 million into that last year. So there's considerable money that's been going into that, or that the legislature's trying to work on that. And I'm just trying to get all these little pots and pools of money, which are substantial amounts of money, of where they're going and how this affects energy as a whole in the state of Alaska. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and keep my questions to a minimum.
Madam Chair, can I address that a minute?
Please, Mr. Harper.
Did you say $200 million? I think figure you used. I believe, Madam Chair, and Representative Newman, I think that's what you said.
Yeah.
That, I believe, is for the weatherization program, again, through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for weatherization improvements on
for low income.
And then there's $100 million, of course, in addition to that, for rebates for without.
But it's to help save energy.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And again, just for the record, I believe what the committee is trying to get their arms around is all the toggles that affect different components of formulas when we go to address energy needs in each community across the state. And so Representative Newman is seeking to understand where the state is currently making investments and how those are made, and then trying to create some kind of formula or district cost factor so that we can appropriately meet those needs throughout the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Harper. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess sort of in line with this discussion your fine presentation is that if it's possible to, and I really like the way that you've gotten all these different studies put together and you've got some numbers for us to look at. And as the chair says, our goal is to try to figure out all the different pieces eventually. And as Representative Newman was making the point that we do have a lot of money in different pots, but it would be really great somehow to be able to figure out two separate things. One, what would be the short fix that would kind of start helping people face next year? And then two, the thing that we could be looking at next session and make sure that we're setting this up so that we're moving towards really comprehensively looking at energy in the state in a way that we don't waste money. And I think that's where Representative Newman's coming from. And I certainly am right with him. I think we do help people that are paying an incredible percentage of their income. We have to do that, but not waste money. And that's the critical thing. So if when you're talking about this, you could maybe design it even more complexly than you've already done, that'd be great. Thank you.
For committee members, Representative Sisna was out of the room briefly getting a question answered. For those at home and those in the audience, we did have the presence of Representative Guerra as well as Representative Dahl has been popping their heads, and Representative Johansson from Southeast have been popping their heads in and out occasionally, but there's not very many chairs left here in Juneau, so just wanted the record to reflect that we do have many people watching from their offices right now, as well as walking by trying to see what's happening in here, because energy is important to this legislative body. So if we could, though, we have other people waiting to speak to us this afternoon, and I would like to at least get through the presentation. The committee is very interested in energy and meeting those needs across the state of Alaska, and that's why the questions are getting generated, Steve. So please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go move the next slide down. And this shows a list of different, I'm not going to read them off, but these show a list of things that are actually available in Alaska. Now, Alaska has blessings and curses. We probably, every place you look in Alaska, there's a resource you can use for something. We have it's a true blessing. But the curse is we have long distances and low usage, and they can make almost any project uneconomic. So as we go through this list, we're trying to find, based on the delivered cost, we're trying to find the best option. We're also having technology teams are looking at each of the technologies to move it forward.
Steve, I'm sorry, you're moving fast, and I appreciate that, but I have no idea what Fischer-Tropsch means.
Fischer-Tropsch.
Tropsch, thank you.
This is actually with the Fairbanks. Fairbanks had an energy summit last Friday, and they're looking in depth at Fischer-Tropsch. This is the methodology you take in Germany in World War II. They actually powered the whole war machine on coal. All their airplanes, so you take coal or any biomass or carbon-based fuel, and you gasify it. When you gasify it, it makes carbon monoxide and hydrogen, which is called syngas, and then you run it through a Fischer-Tropsch unit, which makes paraffin. And it comes out, you know, this paraffin-looking stuff. And then they take it through a refiner and they crack it into the fuels that they want. You can make Jet A, you can make naphtha, you can make diesel fuel, heating oil.
So it's a processing mechanism, yes. Versus an actual resource.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So when you say paraffin, is that just like regular wax? Is that what I think of as wax?
It's basically when you take the syngas with the carbon molecules and the hydrogen molecules, and it makes them into carbon chains. And it looks like paraffin. It's a waxy stuff. If you let it set up, it's like wax. But it's yes. Really a paraffin-based material.
Thank you.
I guess carbon-based material. On the technology evaluation, we set up technology teams. We're involving a lot of members of the public to get their input and get their involvement. And again, we're looking at capital cost and delivered cost. We've met with the 28 communities, and we've talked about that already. The next sheet is going to be an intermediate sheet. This sheet right here that shows the financial model template. This is out of the Fairbanks energy study. And as I was trying to figure out how do I show this for Alaska, this is for one community, one area, and I didn't want to do one of these for each one. So if you go to the next page and the little circles on it, it looks like this. We're going to start, every community is going to have so much energy for heat, electricity, and transportation. And you start there and you start moving the circle out until you get to the resources that you think you can find in the area, whether it's biomass, geothermal, Fischer-Tropsch diesel coming down the Yukon, or hydro, until you can get the enough energy to run that community. There may be some solutions like a Fischer-Tropsch plant, which is really an economy of scale issue. We have to have a large plant, and you may have to connect it and bring it down the Yukon or deliver it some other method, or propane, like the Anger idea, bringing it down the Yukon. So if you look at this little line, you can daisy chain these together to hook communities together. But the end result will be a sheet, something like this, that will show each community what resources are available and what the delivered cost will be to that community on a million BTU basis. So they can look around the ring and say, okay, here's my cheapest option, and then use those resources until they end up getting all the energy they need in that community. They may have to go larger, longer distances to get someplace. In some places, some places may have hydro in their backyard, like Southeast is really blessed that way. So this is really the tool that will allow us every community to look at their community and see what resources are available and what the cost of delivered energy will be to them. So this is really the working tool of this whole study. After that, we'll make a recommendation to the community, and they may come back and say, well, we like your idea about hydro or kinetic hydro, but we don't like the idea about how it's going to affect fish. So they'll go look around the circle and find the next best option. So we're going to absolutely have local feedback. We'd like to identify local companies that exist already or new ones that could be formed, again, in a low-profit model that will allow these to move forward. We're looking for a public-private partnership, so we can leverage state money and get more than just if the state paid for all of it. We'd also like to support power sales agreements with electric utilities so you can get a bankable agreement to move the project forward and to get financing. And we'd also like to work with the institution or financing institutions, whether it's the state, the public, or private institutions for financing. The resources, I guess what we're really looking for are passionate Alaskans who want to help solve the problem. And we've got the AEA team there. We've got local businesses. We have native corporations. We have anybody who has a passion or has an interest in helping solve the problem, we'll bring them into the team. So we're looking for people who want to solve it. The next page is the schedule. Like I said earlier, we'd like to be done with the plan by December, roll it out, and we're working hard. We have a lot of details to go through and a lot of estimates to pull together so we can get some pretty good numbers. But again, this is a very high-level estimate and a study, and we think we can be done by that time. Our current status is we've contracted with ICER to do the fuel studies and actually get the numbers you're asking for, but the earliest they can get them to us would be September 1st. So that's not going to help you for some of your discussions. We've also contracted with ASEP, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, to help us to look at technology review. We've completed our 29 communities. We are working on the technology matrix, and we're working on the evaluation tools. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation, and if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Salmon.
Yes. What really confused me, if you keep coming up with this native corporation, is it the nonprofit, or the for-profit corporations?
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Salmon, I'm talking about for-profit native corporations. Like Fire Island, where SERI has decided they're not going to take a large profit, they're going to be a single-digit profit margin on that project. Mm-hmm. So that type of an approach. So because they're willing to do that because it's taking care of their people in their area. I did not mean to allude that that there would be nonprofit native corporations.
Representative Salmon may be referring to some of the other entities that you identified as anyone that's interested in solving the problem, and I believe that you named some nonprofits inside of that group that might be willing to help.
Okay. I did.
Any other questions from committee members? Steve, one of the issues, again, why the committee thought it was important to hear from you is we were looking for, again, going back to the original press release about Alaska being rich in resources and monetizing our money and having a greater number of dollars coming in this year than we have in the past, and how we were going to invest those dollars in our states. And the administration appropriately identified increased costs across Alaska for energy needs. And we are trying to determine whether now is the time to act or whether we should hold for your energy plan specifically. And again, committee members, if I'm not accurately reflecting what we had talked about in the last 2 weeks, I need you to help me. But we're looking for, as a representative from the administration, knowing that you've been tasked with an energy plan, is this short-term energy relief plan that has now hybrid into a resource rebate plan the right way to go in using $1 billion to help Alaskans?
Okay. Madam Chair, let me explain how I look at this whole process. This is really the long-term plan. We'll call it the short-term, long-term plan. And this is not for this winter. So if you look at the plan and you recommend hydro, that's about 10 years out. That's not going to work, in my opinion. And we need to come up with something that's going to take care of them in the 1 year time frame. So you may pick another option because you can deploy it faster rather than waiting for a really good solution, like a hydro plant that will take care of them for long term. Ahead of that is the short term, okay, in the immediate part of this thing. And the way I kind of characterize it is I'd rather teach you how to fish than give you a fish.
But that's what this committee is struggling with.
And as I internalize that same issue, what I feel is that Alaskans are coming to the legislature and the administration and saying, we're starving to death. So okay, now you have a chance to give them a fish, and you have to say, come see me in the morning. I'll teach you how to fish. That's really about how basic, in my mind, it really is. And I think it's that critical. I don't think we can just say, well, it's not that bad. Just okay. And I was talking the other day, and one person said, well, what can we do? And I said, what can we do for you? And I said, you know, and it's actually a federal group. And I said, you know, I think what we have to do is give them hope, okay? And I'm not being sarcastic at all. Because if you say, I think I have a solution for you in a year, or 2 years, or possibly 3 years, and you're going to be okay. People will still stay in Alaska and survive that, because they'll hunker down and they'll make it work. If you say, I don't know when this plan's coming out, it's sometime in the future, who knows, they're now hopeless. And that's when they're going to start making some decisions to move out of Alaska and leave. And so I think it's a serious situation. I think it's an opportunity to help Alaskans move forward in the short term. Legislature can use their wisdom to determine the exact method. But I think this is really the fish that says, come back and see me in the morning, and I'll teach you how to fish.
Such an opening, but I'm a committee chair, and in doing so, Representative Cisna, followed by Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really do appreciate Steve Higginson's comments. Change is something that we in Alaska have been facing for a long time, and the difficulty of surviving here is something that's ages old. But one of the things that has been troubling me, and pardon me, Madam Chair, for going here, but I think we're going here anyway, in this discussion of exactly how are we going to deal with this at this moment. And it has been obvious to me in the visiting different communities for about 4 or 5 years now, that our state has been growing in the problems in rural Alaska, and that having been here in the mid 80s and being a business person in the mid 80s when we had our very serious little depression in our state, what I found was afterwards the people who survived were poor. And they didn't kind of have that extra fat to live off of. And what I fear for our state is that it's already bad, that there are other sectors of the economy that have been growing, like health, like housing costs, and that we're really adding to it with this huge, sudden, big crisis in energy, and that our people really do need to have significant and, as you say, well thought out help. But because of the state, you visited 28 communities is what I counted.
Personally, but yeah.
Right. There's something like 300 some communities in the state. Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. And they cross the globe in terms of the kind of weather conditions they have, save the deep tropics. I think that'd be a good group to leave out. But that means my concern and the question I'd ask to you is, you visited those places to do this, and we're going to be hearing other people who are also looking at this from their different angles. But what I'm concerned about, as Representative Newman was mentioning, is that we're not duplicating, that we're really trying to concentrate as much as possible to bring all of this stuff together. And is there any talk or is there any effort at putting together a larger group of stakeholders that are sort of geographically representative, and all of these different things that I was seeing that you were measuring in your measurements here that included some of the things were things like transportation and like other kinds of things, that which kind of municipal finances are involved. And I mean, there's a million different things that actually affects each community. And if we're really going to help, we've actually got to do it thinking about some of that. And so I'd love to know what kind of effort there is to really making sure that we're doing this in a really well thought out way so that we don't waste, but we act quickly. And you know what? I think it can be done. I do believe it can be done because it's really an emergency. But what have you heard?
I think, through the chair, Representative Cisna, I think the people of Alaska are looking for help. They're not sure what to do either. And I'm the, pardon me for, I know we're kind of out of time, but pardon me for this sidebar, but when I was meeting with people up in the Nana region, they said, we can't survive on this cost of diesel fuel.
Sure.
Okay? And I kind of believed them.
Yeah.
And I said, well, let me see your regional plan, which they had did a great job on it, right? In the plan, it says our long-term strategy is to use diesel fuel. They didn't know what else that was available. What we're going to do is try and show them available. Now, this is a little side thing here, but there's the five steps of grieving. I call rural Alaska is in acceptance mode, okay, which is the last thing before you die. If you go to Fairbanks, they're mad, okay, because it's just recently gone up a lot. And I apologize in advance. If you go to Anchorage, you're in denial, okay? It's not a problem in Anchorage. And if you go to Southeast, they're going, what problem? My problem is, how do I switch faster to electric heat in my house? Unless you're the diesel people. And that's kind of a blunt generalization, but I'll apologize. But there's kind of a picture across Alaska, because we are a diverse state. We have different positions. We have different opinions. We have different needs. But there's kind of a snapshot of what Alaska is. Okay, one more thing on my soapbox. 30 years ago, I remember Alaska 40 years ago, before the pipeline, that was highly independent and self-reliant. That is not true today. Okay, so part of this plan is to get Alaskans back on their feet, back to be self-reliant and independent. Okay, using their own resources, not importing our food, not importing our resources, not importing anything into Alaska. That's a huge stretch goal. But like Representative Cisna said, I think it can be done. It's going to take a little bit of initiative. It's going to take a little bit of focus, a lot of focus maybe, and I think we can pull it off. And if you don't like that idea, look at the alternative. It's not a pretty picture.
Thank you for your presentation. Certainly as a representative out of an urban area, I am not in denial as a state legislator. I pull up to those gas pumps and my reality shows that my gas is up at least 40% at the pumps, and my electric bill is close to doubling. And you know, I'm not there 6 months out of the year, and my lights are off when I'm gone, at least to the best of my knowledge. So,
Madam Chair, I did a presentation in Anchorage in front of the RDC, and this lady said, we're not in denial. And so I said, okay, show of hands, 150 people in the room, show of hands, how many people have written a letter about the high cost of energy in the last 6 months? Not one hand went up. My comment was, it looks like denial to me. If you walk around Anchorage, I know personally of two people who really are concerned about it, okay? One of them works at the co-op. One of the electric co-op, he's a personal friend of mine for a long time. He's going, oh my God, this is going to be a bad place. We're going to go through the knothole just a little bit after Fairbanks. And, you know, Bush is going through it now. So I think, you know, there's some issues that need to be looked at long-term for Anchorage. And I think right now the cost of Anchorage just looks pretty good. It's going to go up next year, I think, but right now it looks pretty good. So I'm not talking specifically about legislators or you, Madam Chair. What I'm saying is a general rule, it's not the topic in Anchorage. Come to Fairbanks and
I'm
earful.
Well, I'll respectfully disagree. You're not getting my emails. So, Representative Ledoux.
Part of the long-term solution, I understand, would be energy conservation.
Actually, that's just through the chair, Madam Chair. That's the short-term plan. You can do it tomorrow.
How do you square energy conservation with the rebate? For example, I'm looking at, for example, Southeast, where it says, I'm looking at the AEA staff's graph. And so it says total energy consumption Southeast, just slightly under $5,000. So with a family under four, in Southeast at least, if you gave this energy rebate, that would be like $4,800. So there'd be absolutely, unless you're the most green, public-spirited citizen around, absolutely no reason in Southeast to ever even think about turning off the lights if you've got this extra $4,800.
Through the chair, Madam Co-Chair, that's a choice, right? So if you had all your energy paid for, and would you put that money into conservation? Because it's only going to last 1 year. So I'm sure there'll be people that will waste this money. There may be some people that will invest it wisely in conservation. It'll keep the gift that keeps on giving type approach. But that's the concept, is that they will get some relief of some sort.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I said at 3:10 we would start to move on. Representative Olson, you haven't had an opportunity to speak on this.
More a short comment. Several weeks ago, we were given the proverbial three-legged stool again. The first leg was the $1,200. At that point in time, I believe it was $100 a month, and it was on a per capita basis. The second leg of the stool was the rebate to the utilities, which in effect would be needs-based. And the third one was the long-term plan. We're down to one leg right now, with everybody putting demands on that one leg, and it, I've got a feeling it's not going to have a happy ending. That's my only comment at this point in time.
I appreciate that. The committee has been very much engaged in asking for a short-term, a long-term, and a sustainable solution, and I appreciate the high-level coverage. I don't think that we're getting the questions answered that we wanted, and that was an actual direction on if we invest $1,200 right now and share Alaska's wealth in addition to the permanent fund that's going out in October. We're looking at, I guess I'm still coming from the perspective that we were addressing energy, and we're trying to separate those now. And I think that the committee is struggling a bit with that too. But Steve, I'm not sure that you can take us any further down the path of clarity for that. But we do appreciate going out into communities and trying to assess those so that we have a clear understanding of what communities are facing and understanding those toggles. Quickly, Representative Sisnon, follow up so that we can move on.
Last question, and this is directly applying to what you're saying, Madam Chair, and that is, and I don't understand econ well enough to understand exactly how it will work, and want to know if this is something that, Steve, you worked on, and that is explaining what the difference is between how it works, both financially and economically, if we give money to individuals versus giving it to either communities or energy, an energy group or an association or associations. I mean, the different kinds of options that we could have, and how dynamically that works. Because as I understand it, if you give it to individuals, and this is the kind of thing I'd like to know, that's going to not make it possible easily for communities to come up with the funding you need to change your energy mechanisms or what it takes to make energy, that you need bonding, you need things that individuals are not going to get that money and then go over and hand a check to somebody and say, let's do this. And I'm wondering if you can answer that. Are you the right person? Or what part of that can you answer?
Through the chair, I'll attempt to answer that, Representative Sisna. The approach is really to build a private-public partnership, right? If you can get, and if it makes sense on a business level without any subsidy at all, then the state can step in and use their good money to make it better, okay? And so I'd like to evaluate these projects as if there's no help at all. Just a straight-up business deal, going to public bonding, marketing, and finding out what the benefits really are. And so when the state wants to put money into this effort, it will just make the project better. So this is really about Alaskans, and my, like I said earlier, about standing up on their own 2 feet, not going to the legislature with their hand out and saying, give me money to do something for you or for myself. Okay, it's a personal agenda, but I think it's a long-term healthy way to go.
To the committee members, would you like Steve to stay in the audience until the committee work session is done? Is that possible?
I would be happy
to. In case we have other questions. Representative Sisna.
And last one to you, Madam Chair. We are going to be adjourning at some point today, I know. And you said that it would be possible perhaps to have more time on this. And I'm wondering if it's possible for this committee to even meet after this bill goes out, if we decide to do that. and come up with a long-term strategy as one of the things that we do.
We certainly can talk about that. One of the issues that the committee has is that we can call a work session anytime, but there are committee members that have scheduled excused absences right now that are participating in other state business or other items throughout outside of Juneau. So my issue would be how we establish a quorum after that. So it could be a challenge. We certainly have agreed to try to keep to the time schedule, Representative Cisnes, so if you'd like to discuss with other committee members about that time schedule sliding, I'd be happy to do that offline. But we have raised an expectation inside the public that we would try to move this out of here tomorrow. Representative Cisna.
And thank you. In response, my own personal feeling would be I want to do this right. I think this is key to the survival of the state, to the survival of the people in the state, and I think timelines are what sometimes destroy projects that could have made it.
Representative Cisna, I'm willing to put in the time as well as other people. I just...
No. Madam Chair, one more thought. I'm looking forward to HB 152 task force being formed, and I'd be happy to come down and work with that group to help plan the long-term future of this plan.
Okay. Yes, there are some of us that are waiting for appointments onto that task force. The House has been appointment. I believe it's Representative Edgman and myself from the House and Representative Thomas from Southeast. So the House is moving forward with that, and as well as with AGEA, as well as with the energy bill. So we are trying to move the ball forward. So thank you for participating, and I hope that you'll stay with us.
Thank you.
The intent of the chair, with the support of the committee, is to adjourn at 4 o'clock today. If we have additional information that we need to gather, I'll find that out. We will, regardless, take the public testimony beginning at 10 a.m. tomorrow so that the public is shown due respect and as far as their time in joining us. So we'll start that with brief comments at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. I've said that once before here in the Capitol Room 124. And you can access that if you're calling from off-net through a phone number 888-295-4546. Again, 888-295-4546. You'll need to identify yourself for the record. If you're calling in, I'm not sure if we can mute you all as you come in, but please be respectful of other people talking. Identify yourself for the record, and you'll have 3 minutes to join us, and we'll call your name when it's your time to actually speak to the committee tomorrow. Again, public testimony tomorrow morning, and our meeting starts at 10 a.m. With that, we have the Department of Public Assistance, the Division of Public Assistance. Inside the current bill, there was a question regarding a hold harmless clause and anything else that the department would like to give us in their take on the bill. If your name for the record, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services. Before addressing the specific questions, I just wanted to briefly go over the hold harmless provision so you had enough background. The resource rebate would be a one-time $1,200 payment to eligible Alaskans.
John, if I could excuse you just for a moment. So we're addressing HB 4002 for anyone. There are two bills in the committee right now. So
yes, thank you.
Thank you.
The resource rebate is a one-time payment of $1,200. And in some circumstances, that $1,200 rebate will count in determining a person or household's eligibility for public assistance benefits. So the legislation requires, where we are required to do so by federal law, to count those benefits, that we make up the benefits through a hold harmless program. Our total estimated cost, including administration, is about $10.7 million. Primarily, this is the food stamps program, the supplemental security income program, Medicaid, and making up veterans benefits. There's a very small portion that's our adult public assistance program as well. I think as we have looked at the cost, we have anticipated that most people receiving assistance benefits will spend this money relatively quickly. That's been our experience with the permanent fund. And that's been our assumption with the resource rebate as well. With regard to the specific question that came up, I think largely it was around the question of timing and the adequacy of the hold harmless benefit for our public assistance programs. That hold harmless benefit is limited to 4 months. And there was, as I understood it, there was concern that 4 months might be not be long enough, especially after people found out they got it and reported it. And the agencies work those benefits that some month or two would pass already. I wanted to clarify that the 4 months hold harmless actually refers to the benefits they receive, so we would give people up to 4 months of benefits regardless of whether those the rebate affected their benefits immediately or whether it affected their benefits a couple months later. It's not tied to the date of receipt. It's tied to the point at which it affects, actually starts affecting their benefits. And the reason we do that is because different assistance programs have different rules about how you treat these one-time payments. And so sometimes it has an immediate impact on your benefit. Sometimes it has a delayed impact on your benefit. For the veterans, programs. That's an area that's new to us. We don't administer the veterans needs-based programs. That's done by the VA. We would make up their benefits, but they calculate them differently. They, as we understand it, they would take the money received in this calendar year and make a prorated adjustment to benefits in the next calendar year across 12 months. For that reason, this bill 4002 does not have a four-month limit to the hold harmless benefits for VA benefits. So we could make up benefits, their entire loss or their entire reduction or loss of benefits for the year. So we would probably do that in a lump sum payment rather than a monthly payment, but we can. That's why all the other public assistance programs are limited to 4 months, and the VA, the legislation does not include a four-month limit because it would impact their program across 12 months. Now, for our public assistance programs, there is a four-month limit. If people actually retain their benefits for more than the 4 months that they've received the hold harmless payment, they will they would see a reduction or a loss of public assistance benefits. But as with the permanent fund program, I think the thinking is if you are actually in a position that you can keep those benefits that long and don't need to spend them on your needs, then you probably don't need the assistance. So, and I think that was the basic question that was raised in the public hearing about the hold harmless.
Representative Sisna, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair, and I did have a constituent that was very worried about this, and actually, on looking into it, found out that he actually didn't, that he would not be harmed and that it was covered. But he still said that he was really concerned that there might be groups that were just not identifying that maybe under federal aid or something like that. And is that a possibility? Are there possibly programs that the state is not aware of or didn't maybe factor in this?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, we are not aware of any programs. And I think when we looked at this, our experience with the permanent fund program had indicated that the VA was an area that that was affected. And so that was added to the provisions of this bill. Obviously, if I can't tell you that there are programs we're not aware of if we're not aware of them, but based on our experience, we don't believe there's any substantial program. I know we get questions about the Pioneers Homes. The Pioneers Homes would not count this as a benefit. We get questions about AHFC, and we've been informed by AHFC that they wouldn't treat this kind of one-time payment as countable. So the programs we get questioned on, we've checked out, and we're pretty comfortable that we're aware of the major programs. I can't swear we haven't overlooked some program someplace, but.
Thank you. Are there any other questions to the Department of Public Assistance based on HB 4002? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. According to the fiscal analysis number 2, benefit cost assumptions, it starts out, persons who apply for public assistance in the same month they receive the resource rebate or who do not spend the money right away could be affected. So to me that says if people get their energy rebate check and spend it right away, then it would save the money, save up to, if everybody did that, it would save the state $10.7 million. Because you go on further to state that the department estimates that 7,000 households, or 30% of the nearly 24,000 households currently eligible for the food stamp program, will need hold harmless benefits to replace that for 1 month, with an average allotment of $400. And that food hold, that's going to cost $2,800 per household. Also, with Social Security Administration, about 11,500 individuals that receive that is going to hold harmless at another $4,600 a month. To me, this either encourages people to take their $1,200 and spend it right away on something, whether it's energy or something. Can you explain that? Am I assuming that wrong?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I think we've tried to make a few general statements about public assistance, and each one of these programs we describe works a little bit differently. The food stamp program, you're correct. If an individual receives this under the rules of their program, it only counts if they retain it. It doesn't count as income received because it's a one-time unanticipated payment. So if they spend the money right away, you're right, it wouldn't count. But with the hold harmless provision, there's no incentive to the no real incentive to the client to spend it right away. If they need to retain it for some reason for a short period of time, they could do so, and the hold harmless provision would allow them to continue to receive the same level of benefits. For the SSI program, that will be counted as income for at least one month, whether they retain it or not. And if they retain it into the next month, then it would count as an asset, and they'd be eligible for SSI for that additional month, as long as they retained enough that they still exceeded the asset limit for the SSI program. So the different programs work differently. If people spend it quickly, it will overall tend to lower our hold harmless costs. Not in every single program, but well, as a general statement, if they spend it more quickly, it will reduce the amount of hold harmless. We wouldn't get it down to zero, but it would reduce it.
I guess, Madam Chair, if I may, it particularly for the 24,000 households that are getting food stamps, if they spent all this in the first month, it would reduce the hold harmless clause considerably. For Social Security, if they spend it the first month, it would reduce it considerably. But I guess it tells people, when you get this money, make sure you get out and spend it right away, because the state will be saving a lot more money if you do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. On that point, I would just point out inside the fiscal note that we have been advised that there could be an additional appropriation needed for the payouts on this in the year 2010, depending on the hold harmless provisions that are there, that it's a possibility. It does not quantify a number. So just because of the different eligibility requirements and how they're calculated. Representative Ledoux.
Well, if people have to spend this in the first 4 months in order to be held harmless, then what are they going to do with their energy costs for the rest of the year, which is, I thought, one of the purposes of this bill?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, they can prepay or pre-purchase their energy. They can prepay their rent so that they have additional funds to pay their energy costs as they need them. They there are things they can do with the money that would help them in the future, reduce their future costs so that they have the money for energy.
Representative Ledoux.
And prepaying those things then wouldn't count as an asset that might have an effect on their benefits?
Through the chair, I will look to the other folks in the Division of Public Assistance to help me out if I misstate it, but it's my understanding that purchasing such things as rent and energy would not in all of the programs we work with. We don't work directly with the VA. When we discussed it with the VA, they really look only at the level of income and make an annual adjustment, so any kind of pre-purchasing wouldn't affect how that determination was made.
Thank you.
Excellent question, Representative Ledoux. Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following Representative Ledoux's question, this sounds like to me that that there is a complexity to the recipients of the aid that are affected by this legislation. And what plan is there to make sure that the recipients understand what the choices are in how they spend this money and the consequences? Because the consequences are going to greatly affect people in their future. And is there a strategy on that?
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, we already provide information about the permanent fund and the permanent fund hold harmless programs, and I think we envision doing something similar with this program to educate our recipients how this would affect their benefits, how the hold harmless would work. It is a factor in when you look at our administrative costs. We have factored in additional staff time to answer questions with our clients, because we expect that they will have many questions about this, and that's one of the reasons we've asked for the additional staff.
Good.
So.
Good.
Thank you. Any other questions for John?
Well, I was just wondering if we could get an AG's opinion that prepaying rent and prepaying for fuel would not be considered an asset for these public assistance programs. Because just in regular, ordinary, everyday parlance, I think most people would consider that if you had 4 months of rent paid or 4 months of fuel that is already prepaid, most of us would consider that as an asset.
We do have online Mike Mitchell, and I believe Chris is here from the Department of Law. Would anybody like to take that on right now? Or I think Representative Ledoux is asking for a written opinion, which is entirely appropriate, but if you'd like to answer on the record for us today.
For the record, my name is Stacey Crayley. I'm with the Department of Law, and I would concur with Mr. Sherwood's statement that it's not considered an asset, but I will prepare something in writing for the committee to confirm that opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell, are you still online?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Do you concur with what's been said to the committee today, or do you have something else to add to that?
I have nothing else to add. Ms. Crayley has been the lead attorney in looking at the various hold harmless issues, so she would be the appropriate person to prepare whatever response is appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Thank you, Stacey. Mm-hmm. Any other questions from committee members on this point? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
With that, there was a question from Representative Ledoux earlier regarding the utilities, contribution to the utilities, and that was something that Representative Olson referred to as a second leg of the school that, stool that we had talked about trying to balance Alaska's energy needs on. And I see that we have members online holding from RCA, and I was wondering if that would be any kind of question that might want to be directed to RCA regarding the utility payment.
For me, Madam Chairman, my question related to Mr. Higginson's question relating to whether this would be taxable, considered taxable income to the taxpayer, and I'm not sure that that would be something that the RCA could answer.
No question.
Then I have a question. Are people from RCA still online, Rich?
Yeah. I have Dennis Wheeler and Mary Vittoni with us.
Thank you. We had heard early on about a contribution, and again, it's a media soundbite, so if it's inappropriate, I apologize. My recollection is that we had talked about contributing to energy companies throughout the state, and one of the arguments that was rumored against that was that the RCA would have to go back in and recalculate tariff charges if we were to somehow lower the rate. And then the second curiousness about it was whether we would actually see a reduction in consumer rates if we were to allocate dollars to utilities to reduce individual payers' costs. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, I have Mary Vittoni, head of our tariff section. She can probably deal with the tariff implications of that proposal. But Dennis Wheeler, the head of the advisory section manager, may wish to speak on that.
And again, we have nothing in front of us, nor an amendment, nor a bill. It's just that Representative Olson talked about a utility contribution, and that was the questions that I had for the utility contribution. So if anyone could speak to that in a general form, it would be helpful.
Madam Chair, this is Dennis Wheeler. With respect to the question about the effect on the tariffs that the utilities have, there would have been most likely some sort of trigger that would have required changes to all of the tariffs on file with us and the approval processes associated with that if the energy rate were changed. With respect to rate making generally and the tax implications, I would say with respect to tax implications, we did not work to answer or resolve that particular question. With respect to rate making, if the utilities were given some sort of assistance, there were some informal discussions about the implication in terms of overall rate making and how to treat those funds if provided to the utility and what impact that would have. I do not recall that any formal proposal was given to us or a request or any sort of formal opinion was asked of us, so I think that was briefly discussed informally but didn't hold water or gain any traction as far as assignments to us to resolve that. But there would have been a significant amount of work generated here at the RCA to deal with the implications of such a proposal.
Any questions or follow-up from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Thank you for joining us online. We're going to continue on. It's my intent, we have a floor session scheduled for 4 o'clock today. I haven't heard any information contrary to that, so I'd like to be finished with this meeting in about 10 minutes, which would put us out at 10 to 4, so members of this committee can go back to their offices and collect what they need to go to the House floor. With that, I'd like to bring the Department of Revenue forward and anyone that he would like to have join him at the table to discuss 4002 and if we have questions on 4003. Any opening comments, and if you could identify your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue, and with me is Randy Ruaro from the Governor's Office. I don't have any opening remarks, but there were a number of issues that were brought forth in committee that we have discussed and have, I believe, prepared an amendment to address that we would like to discuss with you. One of the issues was a concern about having in the bill the requirement for people to have a physical address in order to apply, and I think we would prepare an amendment that would
Mr. Burnett, if I could bring the committee up to speed, if you could, if the committee members could pick up, do you have amendments? Amendment number 25G-4, it's an administrative amendment that is for your consideration. It's not before us now, but that's what Mr. Burnett would like to speak to.
Okay, the first issue was the question of having a physical address, and the amendment suggests that we would require a physical address if it was available. If not, a mailing address would suffice. So that was that's the first amendment, and as an administrative matter, I think that we can handle that. We believe that we should get physical addresses when possible. There's a lot of information there, especially if we end up with doing any fraud control efforts or audits in the future with this.
So the administration is supportive of an escape valve, basically.
Right.
If we can't get the information, it can be proven that it's not readily accessible, that for those in rural or remote communities or other places that have
zip
codes or a postal service readily available.
It would not be our intent to deny a person the resource rebate because they didn't have a physical address that they could.
Thank you.
The second issue was one that was brought, that's in that amendment, is one that was brought up about the wording in the original bill, which spoke to being voluntarily present in the state, and it was brought up in the context of someone who was here on military orders. And so what the amendment, which we would support if you choose to add it to the bill, is that the person, there's one other issue, which is temporary absences, which is in this section, that the person had to be present in the state from April 1 to October 1st, and on the date that they apply, which would be during the application period, they intend to remain in the state, and a temporary absence from the state of less than 30 days does not disqualify the person. We did not want it, so we had to say you could never have been gone, you can't go visit your family or whatever. And then if a person is serving on active duty as a member of the armed forces, is eligible to receive hostile fire, imminent danger pay, and except for the active duty service would qualify. So that would apply for people who were out of state only because of active duty. Go ahead.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burnett, I'm working with a constituent right now, actually working with you in your office on this one. I think you probably know which one it is, about they were absent because of medical circumstances last year, more than a required time, so they were not given a permanent fund dividend. They were not allowed to get one by the state. If that person was, again, and they've been residents of the state for a long time, again, were outside the state because of medical reasons, with cancer and having to get services that are not available within the state, those more than 30 days within this six-month period, then they're not going to be eligible for this again?
To the Chair, Representative Newman, I can't speak to the specifics of the case you're referring to. I believe there's some appeals and legal case going on, but the situation here does not allow for the allowable absences that are present under the permanent fund dividend statute. If the person qualified for the dividend for this year, they would be getting this resource rebate automatically under the terms of the bill. So this is our second group of people with a separate qualification. So that long-term resident under a medical allowable absence may, or depending on the specific circumstances, may or may not qualify, but would not necessarily qualify under this if they didn't qualify under the other.
Even though they've been a long-time resident and intend to stay here and just have some medical problems?
Through the Chair, Representative Newman, that under the language in the legislation, that would be correct.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So I'm just sort of wondering, on page 3 of the bill, was voluntarily at line 3, physically present in the state for the period from April 1st to October 1st, 2008, and it doesn't allow for the same sort of exceptions that it would if you were applying for your permanent fund dividend. So would that mean that a person who takes a weekend in Seattle and they're in the state from April 1st, 2008 through October 1st, 2008, they'd have to be present in the state every single day? Is that what the intention of this is?
Through the chair to co-chair Ledoux, in answer, that's what the original language in the bill could have resulted in that situation, which would be undesirable for a number of reasons. And so the proposed amendment, which we have given to the committee, would allow for up to 30 days of that period for a person to be gone for any reason without exception.
And where is that on the?
That's in the amendment on lines 7 through 13 of amendment 25G4.
So then you've got a six-month residency requirement that you're then reducing by an entire 30 days? I mean, that's quite a – I mean, I can understand it if somebody's out of the state for maybe a weekend, but 30 days out of a 60 – out of a six-month residency period, that just seems like a pretty significant period.
To the chair, Ledoux, it may be that this committee decides that this 30 days is not the right number, but this is our proposal in the amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. If I might comment on the or make a question on the residency requirement, April 1st to October 1st for Alaska does mean that many people, Alaskans, would be out trying to enjoy the summer, fishing, mm-hmm. and other activities inside of our state. But some, as Representative Ledoux and the administration have noted, may travel to visit family and friends in other locations. Why did the administration choose April 1st through October 1st? Do you have a reason?
Yeah, Representative Faircloth, in answer to that question, the advice was to go to a six-month residency requirement. The choice of a application period from October 1 to November 30th put us where it's a defined period of time. April 1 happened to be 6 months previous to that. We are already giving the resource rebate to anyone who is a long-term Alaskan and qualifies for the permanent fund dividend, so they were here all through 2007 up to this point. And this also requires that a person continues to be in the state and intends to remain. So that six-month residency requirement, yes, people could be out for the summer. It's more likely that a long-term Alaskan would be out for the winter, perhaps. So, but this also would mean that the people who were just here for the summer would have already left on October 1. In many cases. So it's a balance. I think it's a decision. The April 1 to November 30th or October 1 to November 30th application period was chosen because that gives us enough. It's the soonest we believe that we could do an application, get it out to people, and have a rational chance of people not missing it.
Representative Olson has a question, but my follow-up is that that's also the period of time when Alaskans bring in the most seasonal workers from everywhere around the world to work. And I understand we've heard that they have to sign that they're going to remain, but it's the highest portion of our seasonal workers, too. And so, Representative Olson.
So, Jerry, we're going to offer energy rebates and credits to upwards of 45,000 people that weren't here last winter and didn't have additional fuel cost, heating cost, electric cost.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, it's probably not quite accurate because
pulled out of the fiscal note.
We're not talking about people who weren't here through last winter. We're talking about people who have arrived in the state for the first time or not been continuously present, but they arrived in the first time sometime after January 1 of 2007, because to be qualified for a 2008 permanent fund dividend, you had to be a resident of the state as of January 1, 2007, and for the entire period of 2007. So many, if not most of these people, would have been here through the 2000 2007-2008 winter.
Representative Olson.
So if we use the permanent fund for the qualification, we would hit the people that actually had costs for last winter, additional fuel costs, additional heating costs, the people in Fairbanks that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, while that's true, we would also miss perhaps 40,000 people who have moved into the state. We, according to the Department of Labor, about 41,000 people per year have been moving into the state. And those people who have moved in since January 1, 2007. So a lot of those people will have been here through the winter of 2008 and had those expenditures during the previous year and during the summer.
One last follow-up.
Representative Olson.
Is it possible to break out the people that would be here after the first of the year that would qualify and the people going back to 2007? Just a rough number. Not right now, but for tomorrow.
To the Chair, Representative Olson, I can try. It's difficult, but it may be possible.
And again, speaking to Representative Olson's concern is that the permanent fund has been tested in court as far as eligibility requirements go. And this committee is concerned, or this legislator is concerned, with expanding those eligibility requirements and that payout to Alaskans who may have just arrived and who may not be planning on staying, and just want to make sure that if we're going to invest a resource rebate across the state, that it's done in an equitable manner to benefit Alaskans.
And if I could respond to that quickly, some of the people we're talking about here have been here for, will have been here for 22 months as of October 1, and not have been able to have qualified for the dividend. If you're talking about new arrivals, it's people of up to 22 months.
I think you've been clear.
Okay.
There are other components of your amendment. We are past the 10-minute marker to get there. Is there anything else that you'd like to add for our consideration prior?
If I could, just real quickly, there were two others that I think are fairly important, and one was child custody issue, which was brought up, of which parent has which, and the amendment addresses that on page 2, lines 11 through 14, requiring that it would go to the one that has more than 50% custody. And then the other issue that was brought up that is important was the garnishment for child support purposes. And on page 2, lines 18 through 20, this amendment would allow for administrative levy without exception for child support, not other programs. And the reason for not other programs is because of technical difficulties and timing, not because it, you know, child support we can do internally and electronically, so it can be done in the context of a separate payment.
I appreciate you explaining so that the public knows what's going to be considered. Representative Cisna, did you want to speak briefly or read your proposed amendment in, or are you going to not?
Madam Chair, the amendment is actually somewhat complicated, and I cannot do it briefly, and I especially cannot do it briefly because I absolutely have to be in this floor session. I've got things to pick up and enough duties that I don't have time. I'm awfully sorry.
I'll read it into the record then, what this committee's received.
Yes, please. Would that be? All right.
Representative Cisna has put before the committee an allocation of funding distribution resources for energy relief shall be calculated on a formula using heating degree days and average regional costs of 1 gallon of heating fuel or BTU equivalent. And so my concern as chair will be that we're talking about a resource rebate, and again defining whether it's a resource rebate or an energy rebate, whether I would support. Representative Olson, you had proposed an idea. Would you like to speak to it now?
We can go to like tomorrow, but you can read it across.
Representative Olson is proposing that we match it's a full page, so the title is a full page. An act relating to Alaska resource rebates and increasing the amount of the 2008 permanent fund dividend by the amount of the rebate and providing for an effective date. So that would match up the eligibility requirements that we were talking about personally. And then Representative Newman has one for our consideration that, again, went to a debt owed to a state agency or a state entity, a child support obligation required by the courts, or decisions of child support service agencies under AS 25-27.140, notwithstanding. So that gives an idea for the public of what will be considered. We'll see you at, I hope, 10 a.m. tomorrow morning here in Juneau. With that, we're adjourned.